KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
And essentially they're in like a judicial black hole, disappeared into one of the most brutal prisons in the hemisphere.
A look inside the El Salvador prison President Trump has made central to his deportation plans. For Sunday, March 23rd, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. After 5 weeks of serious health problems, Pope Francis has been released from the hospital and has returned to the Vatican.
I've been praying for him, and I've been attending the Holy Rosary, and I know that God answers our prayers.
We'll look at that. We will also look at the legal theory at the heart of President Trump's efforts to expand the power of the presidency.
The unitary executive theory is a muscular understanding of a president's Article II powers.
Plus, the history behind the satirical newspaper The Onion, that and more after this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Ceasefire negotiations got underway in Saudi Arabia today between Ukrainian and American delegations ahead of talks on Monday between the U.S. and Russia. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports President Trump says he wants to end the war, but Moscow launched massive drone attacks on Kyiv this weekend that killed at least three people.
Air defenses battled a massive drone attack Saturday night in Kyiv. On Sunday, the city mourned. People gathered at an apartment block that was struck and where people died. 19-year-old Tatiana, who doesn't want to give her last name, says it could happen to any of us.
Last 3 months, it's everyday bombing, and it's everyday, like every night. It's a terrible sound, and you just laying in your bed and thinking, oh my God, this bomb going to my house or near.
In his nightly speech Sunday, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said it should be clear to everyone that Russia is the one who is dragging this war out. He called on Ukraine's allies to put more pressure on Russia to end the war. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Kyiv.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio spoke with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today. The State Department says Rubio reiterated U.S. support for Israel's ongoing military operations in Gaza. Rubio also said the administration remains committed to restoring freedom of navigation in the Red Sea. One of the largest unions of U.S. postal workers is holding rallies across the country today to protest the Trump administration's proposals to transform the USPS. NPR's Hansi Lo Wang reports Trump officials have floated the idea of bringing the independent mail agency under White House control.
U.S. mail, not for sale!
Members of the National Association of Letter Carriers in cities including Silver Spring, Maryland, demonstrated against comments last month by President Trump. He cited troubled finances at USPS and said his administration is considering having the Commerce Department take control of what Congress set up to be an independent postal service. Legal experts say that would likely violate federal law. NALC union steward Kevin Abernathy says he's also concerned about talk of privatizing the country's mail service.
If they carve up and sell the postal service, we will lose small businesses, seniors, veterans, royal families, and everyday customers who trust us to deliver.
The Union of Rural Letter Carriers is set to rally Tuesday on Capitol Hill. Hansi Lo Wang, NPR News, Silver Spring, Maryland.
The White House says Second Lady Usha Vance will travel to Greenland this week to visit historical sites. President Trump has repeatedly said he wants the U.S. to buy the island. The Prime Minister of Greenland has sharply criticized Trump for his proposal, noting that the island is not for sale. This is NPR News. Hockey fans are watching the Washington Capitals closely, specifically its star Alex Ovechkin. He needs only 7 more goals in the Capitals' final 12 games this season to pass Wayne Gretzky in scoring the most goals in a career. New research shows that seals can perceive internal oxygen levels to keep themselves from drowning. NPR's Jonathan Lambert reports it's the first time that such an ability has been demonstrated in animals.
When humans hold their breath, the urge to breathe is driven by a buildup of carbon dioxide in our blood, not oxygen. That's the case for virtually all other mammals, but not for gray seals, according to a study published in the journal Science. Researchers varied the amount of oxygen and carbon dioxide captive gray seals could breathe and then watched how long they stayed underwater to find food. The higher the oxygen levels, the longer seals stayed under. But carbon dioxide levels had little effect, suggesting seals evolved a new way of not drowning. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
Late night talk show host Conan O'Brien will receive the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor at the Kennedy Center tonight. He was named the latest recipient of the honor in January, about 3 weeks before President Trump ousted the longtime president and replaced board members who'd been appointed by Democrats. The board then named Trump chairman of the traditionally nonpartisan organization. I'm Windsor Johnston, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. In recent days, President Trump has embraced prisons in El Salvador. On Friday, he took to his Truth Social page to threaten anyone caught vandalizing Tesla dealerships with prison sentences in El Salvador. Those remarks and the president's decision to deport hundreds of migrants that he says are in a criminal gang there have put the country's prisons in the spotlight. And in fact, for the past 3 years, El Salvador has repeatedly touted the cruelty with which it treats its prisoners. Its methods have been condemned by human rights groups. NPR's Eder Peralta reports.
Back in March of 2022, the world was shocked by the videos being released by President Nayib Bukele of El Salvador. The government had just declared a state of exception, suspending some basic civil rights. The videos showed alleged gang members dressed in white boxers being manhandled by guards. At the time, human rights groups and even the U.S. State Department decried what they called human rights abuses, including torture and cruel and inhuman treatments. In the end, El Salvador jailed some 85,000 people. In 2023, President Bukele inaugurated a massive new jail, the Terrorism Confinement Center, with a 30-minute documentary that aired on national TV.
Pelotones, alto!
It showed the president touring a pitch-black solitary confinement cell, taking pride that prisoners would have to sleep on concrete or cold steel, and especially that the prisoners here, terrorists, he said, would never leave. They won't leave for any trial dates, Bukele says. They won't have the opportunity to cause any more chaos. That prison is where the United States sent more than 200 Venezuelan migrants, the U.S. says, are suspected gang members. And this time, both the U.S. and Salvadoran authorities released videos showing the rough treatment of the migrants.
We should be very concerned.
That's Noah Bullock, who runs Cristosal, a human rights organization in El Salvador.
And essentially, they're in like a judicial black hole, disappeared into one of the most brutal prisons in the hemisphere.
Bullock says El Salvador is running an intentionally brutal system with little due process. Cristosal has documented at least 367 deaths. At the same time, President Bukele has consolidated power. 3 years into a state of exception, his party now controls all three branches of government, and the government has jailed people not connected with gangs. Bukele did bring peace to El Salvador, and he often says his wide popularity is proof this is the approach Salvadorans want. With that, Bullock says, Bukele has succeeded in normalizing both cruelty and an all-powerful executive.
The state of exception in El Salvador has become so normalized I think that nobody questions the premise that the state can do whatever it wants to whoever it wants, and there's no institution that could intervene to protect your rights.
Finula Nieloin, a professor at the University of Minnesota Law School, was one of the UN experts who warned that El Salvador was using the threat of terrorism to trample on the rights of its citizens. She says what Bukele is doing is nothing new. Invoking terrorism to subjugate a country was done in Cold War Europe or in present-day China and Russia. What's different is that the United States is not only endorsing the Bukele tactics, but is paying El Salvador to jail its deportees.
We have a very dangerous situation in that we have a P5 member of the Security Council of the United States acting like a rogue state.
Nieloin says, historically, people have tended to accept and applaud a period of, quote, ill-mannered leaders doing ill-mannered things. It happened during the military dictatorships of the 70s and 80s in Latin America.
But ultimately, people understood that the violence and the cruelty and the harm of that was simply intolerable to a decent society.
What's clear, she says, is that sooner or later, El Salvador and the United States will have their own moment of reckoning. Ada Peralta, NPR News, Mexico City.
Here are some headlines for you. Kitten thinks of nothing but murder all day long. Everyone involved in pizza's preparation, delivery, purchase, extremely high. Defiant Milosevic eats big sloppy sandwich during trial. Those are just three headlines from maybe millions to choose from that at one point or another have graced the front page of the satirical news outlet The Onion, America's finest news source, as it has long called itself, and also a leading pioneer in modern news satire. Its headlines, as you can probably tell by now, are often a range of absurd spin on real news, or goofy jokes, or sly subversiveness. The Onion has been around for nearly 40 years now, but where did it come from and how did it become so influential? That is the story that author Christine Wentz, who was a member of The Onion's original staff, writes in her new book, Funny Because It's True, How The Onion Created Modern News Satire. Christine, welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get into the history, can I ask what some of your favorite Onion headlines from over the years are?
One of my favorites, I think, is archaeologists uncover ancient race of skeleton people. I have a penchant for the silly ones. I like the raccoon headlines, too. But there are some good political ones also.
I was talking to Stephen Thompson, who works here now and worked for The Onion for a long time. And he said he loves the ones that can kind of write an entire story in one line. Like winner didn't even know it was a pie eating contest.
Right. Yeah, that's a really good one. Yeah.
And The Onion now is something people consume on social media. It's a website. It's a video platform. It's a bunch of multimedia things. In the beginning, it was really just a tiny newspaper, newsletter almost, in Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah, it was basically a form of the Alt Weekly, which was, you know, really having a resurgence around that time, I think. It was probably, you know, 8 to 30 pages long, something like that, most of the time, supported by advertisements. And the rest was all made up, pretty much.
And the book really gets to the fact, I mean, this is really in many ways a love letter to Madison, Wisconsin, where The Onion was founded.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about what made that place so special during the years we're talking about here when The Onion gets up and running?
When I think about that question, a lot of it is weirdly around economics. It was cheap to live in Madison. You could get by on a minimum wage job and still have time for projects and a social life. And, you know, rent was cheap, you know, so it was really a place where young people had the kind of space to try new stuff.
What's the best way you would describe the sense of humor of the early group of writers? Was it an ironic place? Was it goofy humor? Like what was going for laughs in those pitch meetings?
At the time, there weren't really, it was more loose than pitch meetings even. You know, it's like, it's a Gen X thing. So there's lots of irony and multi-layeredness. There were local improv comedians writing, you know, there were folks of that ilk, you know, kind of hanging around the office. So shows like David Letterman were really popular then. So there was a more absurdist kind of tabloidy vibe, I think, at the beginning. And later it turned into the more straight AP style that people think of The Onion for today.
Yeah, I guess for older listeners, a Letterman sense of humor from the 80s. You know exactly what we're talking about.
Exactly, yeah.
You write in your book about the early years when people working at the paper kind of realized, you know what, we can have a political point of view. We're going to express it when it makes sense to, and we're going to have it kind of work its way into our humor. What was the touch point for that?
Well, editor Rob Siegel at the time, he remembered an abortion bumper sticker debate that they were going to put. And their impulse was to post two different sides of the abortion debate on the front cover, but then he thought, well, no, let's just pick a side here. And at that point, The Onion, you know, sort of picked up the mantle of fighting Bob La Follette, right? And became often, I think, a progressive voice and a kind of, they're in favor of the area men and area women. You know, they support them, even though they sometimes make fun of them. That's important for The Onion's kind of political point of view.
I'm glad you worked area man into this interview.
Yeah, I had to do that, yeah.
One moment in particular, and I am of the age that I remember physically seeing this issue and just the tension-breaking laughter that it brought me in a very tense moment. This is the first Onion to be published after 9/11. I'm going to read just a few of the headlines. U.S. vows to defeat whoever it is we're at war with. American life turns into bad Jerry Bruckheimer movie. Not knowing what else to do, woman bakes American flag cake. Hijackers surprised to find selves in hell. This is ironically right as the creative staff had moved to New York City. This would have been the first issue they were putting out as a New York-based publication no matter what. Then 9/11 happens. No one knows when and what is appropriate to make jokes. The Onion staff thinks it over. Pick up the story there and tell me how this iconic issue comes together.
You know, they write about things that they're thinking about themselves. That's what I would learned in like the million interviews I did. And of course, they had just gone through this situation in New York City along with all the other New Yorkers. And they were very apprehensive about the response that it was going to get. And luckily, it actually made people feel very much better, and it gave people a lot of relief and their first laugh, and really took a stand and went out there like before other people did, and kind of made it okay to be funny again. And I think a lot of comedy people in particular like really, really respect them for that.
And that really was a moment that elevated The Onion's brand, right?
Yeah. Their readership apparently doubled in response to that, and they got a lot of attention for sure.
A serious topic like that leads to just the constant onslaught of very serious news that our news cycles have put themselves into in recent years. And the fact that, you know, misinformation, I think, plays such a key part in some of the stories that are consuming all of us. You wrote that this is part of the reason why you wanted to write this history of The Onion, that the very intense news of today and the question about truth ironically made you think of this satirical newspaper.
It did, yeah. And the kind of conclusion I've reached on that is that the Onion is good fake news, right? Yeah. The Onion is trying to make the world a better place. I mean, that's ultimately the position of satire, even at its most cutting and sardonic. That's what satire wants to do. It wants to help. It's trying to point out what's wrong. The bad fake news is trying to wreck the whole idea of truth and shared reality and sow chaos and all of that stuff. And it's a very, very different mission than what The Onion is doing.
That is Christine Wentz, author of Funny Because It's True, How the Onion Created Modern News Satire. Christine, I feel like I should tell you before we go that the sports team from my area is superior to the sports team from your area.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks for talking.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Windsor Johnston with these headlines. Pope Francis has returned to the Vatican. The 88-year-old pontiff was hospitalized in Rome for 5 weeks. He's recovering from a severe respiratory infection that developed into pneumonia. The health ministry in Gaza says the number of Palestinians killed since the start of the war against Hamas has surpassed 50,000. The conflict broke out more than a year ago when the militant group attacked Israel. The governor of South Carolina has declared a state of emergency because of a large wildfire. In North Carolina, a mandatory evacuation order was issued last night for wildfires burning in Polk County. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Pope Francis returned to the Vatican today. The milestone marked the end of a five-week stay in the hospital, a stay where at times Pope Francis battled for his life as he dealt with double pneumonia. Before leaving Rome's Gemelli Hospital, the 88-year-old pontiff made his first public appearance in over a month. NPR's Ruth Sherlock was there.
Hundreds of people are arriving here outside the front of Gemelli Hospital in Rome, and they're smiling, and it's a sunny day. And they're all here to see Pope Francis, who's being discharged from this hospital today after 38 days. This is a scene that might have seemed unlikely a few weeks ago. At times, Pope Francis was in critical condition, and prayers were being held for the 88-year-old pontiff by faithful who feared for his survival. Today, the atmosphere is one of celebration.
Today I came because I'm happy. Today is my birthday and Pope is discharged during my birthday.
Priscilla Wangari is a Franciscan nun from Kenya living in Rome.
I want to receive blessings from Pope. I've been praying for him and I've been attending the Holy Rosary and I know that God answers our prayers.
The French doors open on a balcony above us, and Pope Francis appears. He looks over the crowd and then spots something that makes his expression light up. He asks an aide for the microphone and speaks. After thanking everyone, he says, "I see this woman with the yellow flowers. Well done." The woman is 79-year-old Carmela Vittoria Mancuso, who told Vatican media afterwards, while overcome with emotion, that she didn't imagine the Pope would focus on her. Pope Francis's appearance was brief, and he still does not look a well man. His face was swollen, and he was coughing as aides wheeled him away from the balcony. But his discharge from hospital is a stunning improvement for the 88-year-old pontiff after a long illness that at times left him in a very critical condition that put his life in danger. During much of his hospital stay, the Vatican organized nightly prayers for his recovery. At a mass in the Lateran Basilica, the Catholic Cathedral of Rome, 1 month ago, many of the faithful cried with worry for the Pope as they prayed. Now at Rome's Gemelli Hospital, some in the crowd have tears of joy, like Giulia Giannarelli.
È un'emozione ritrovare la speranza che porta il Papa.
It's emotional, she says, to again find the hope that the Pope brings, so close, so mixed up in our lives. The Pope is our heart, says Italian Simona Bini. She says she appreciates how he's focused on poverty in his papacy and how he tries to remain grounded, often refusing some of the grander outfits and accommodation offered to a Pope. This is important, she says, because even priests or cardinals can lose touch with the public or with people who suffer. Shortly afterwards, Pope Francis left the hospital in the front seat of his usual modest white Fiat 500 car. Even as he returns to the Vatican, the Pope has a long recovery ahead of him. Speaking at a press conference before he was discharged from hospital, Francis's doctors said he would need rest and rehabilitation for a further 2 months. The Pope had been set to meet with Britain's King Charles in April and to lead the Vatican's annual Easter celebrations. The Vatican hasn't said if Francis will be able to keep those engagements. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome.
When you're on the road as a reporter, you're bound to pick up some local vernacular.
There's this word that a woman that we met in Greenland told us. It's called Sila, which means weather, but it also means, like, you can't control the weather. You just have to adapt around it.
That, of course, is All Things Considered co-host Juana Summers. Last month, she and a team went to Greenland for a reporting trip and encountered a ton of Sila.
One thing to know about traveling in Greenland is that there are not roads between the major towns and cities, so you've got to take these little small flights on Air Greenland to get from place to place.
One place they were trying to get to was a little town north of the Arctic Circle called Ilulissat. But the Sila had other ideas. They hit days of high winds and icy tarmacs.
We were supposed to leave on a Thursday. No flight happens. The next day we get up, we pack all our stuff, we get to the airport. We get on a plane. Plane gets diverted. We land in a completely different part of Greenland. We're there for like a half hour or something like that. Back on the plane. The cycle plays out over and over again. Finally, I think this is on Sunday. Pack up all our stuff, leave the hotel, get on the plane again. Plane gets diverted again to this place called Aasiaat. So we're now here at the Aasiaat Airport in Greenland. On our way, we're attempting again for the third time to fly to Ilulissat. We're going to see if we're going to make it. And finally, after about 2 hours of sitting there and wondering what's going to happen, this announcement comes over the loudspeaker. It is in either Greenlandic or Danish languages I do not speak. I didn't have to understand those languages to know what was happening because everybody started cheering. And we actually made it 4 days later.
To understand that, it seems like we're going to make an attempt to fly to Ilulissat. I don't know if you can hear the crowd got pretty excited, the small group of us that have been.
What was Ilulissat like when you finally got there? What did it look like?
I mean, it's one of the most stunning places I've ever visited. It's this sort of scenic, beautiful tourist town. It's a place where lots of people go to set out and see the icebergs, to take boat tours. All of the houses are super colored. There's beautiful snowscapes. And I think the thing that sticks with me is the fact that you can just hear the sled dogs howling all the time. Like, even before you see them, you can hear them. And then when you see them, they're also pretty darn cute.
Juana and the team went to Greenland because of the bold claims President Donald Trump has made about taking it over. But it's a place with a lot more to cover than political jostling. So today, for our weekly Reporter's Notebook segment, we are on the road in Greenland, and we will start in that little town with those pretty darn cute sled dogs, Ilulissat.
So we did this story, and this is something I wouldn't have thought about before we started researching this trip, about the intersection of dog sledding and climate change. So we actually got to go out with this woman who's a dog sled musher named Stella, and when she took us out, she kind of warned us, you know, we don't have a lot of snow right now. It's actually pretty hot here. And when we don't have as much snow, it's harder for the dogs to pull.
All right, I think we've righted things. They're picking up speed again.
And we're kind of looking out in front of us, and you can see some snow, but there's like also these stretches of just sort of rough terrain. There are rocks and moss, and
we just went across a pretty big rock.
It's kind of brown looking, so we're seeing this in real time. And that is definitely the case when we took off on this dog sled. Like, it just, there wasn't enough snow in some stretches, which meant that we were getting off the dog sled at times and running alongside of it.
Had you dog sledded before in your life?
Nope.
How would you say you were as a dog sledder?
I mean, I'm I would like to say that I'm very good at following directions.
Okay.
I think it helps that, like you, I'm a runner. So running alongside of it, I was definitely looking at my Garmin like, man, maybe I should have started my Garmin. My heart rate is really up.
Just get on.
Just get on. Easier said than done.
Before we talk about the other topics, what, for people who didn't hear the piece, what is the general feeling, though, of people whose livelihood depends on this tourism industry, depends on snow, when north of the Arctic Circle in February, snow is a problem?
Yeah, I think it touches every part of life there. When we talked to Stella, the woman who took us out with the dog sleds, or when we talked with a man named Jan Kortsen, who took us out on his boat to the icebergs, there's a concern. These are people who have lived in Greenland their whole lives, and they're pointing to these tangible examples every day of how climate has affected them. And the other thing that we heard from them, and particularly from Jan Kortsen, is these are all people who depend on tourism, right? Mm-hmm. They want more people to come to this small town of fewer than 5,000 people to go on their dog sleds, to go out on their boats. But they want to make sure that as Greenland opens up more to the world, the island has invested a ton of money in new airports and stuff. They want that money to stay locally rather than to benefit outside operators. And that's a really big tension in the small town that we went to, too.
Speaking of outsiders, President Trump wants to acquire Greenland. This is something you, as a reporter, want to learn about. But you are also an American coming in from an American news outlet to talk to people about this. How were you received?
We were pretty well received. One thing that we were warned about from people that we were talking to in pre-interviews is that there was just a lot of fatigue around international journalists and American journalists. And you could really see that. I mean, as we were walking around Nuuk in particular, we saw tons of other journalists. Several other big U.S. outlets were there at the same time we were there.
Yeah.
People were nice, but people were pretty over it at times. I'll give you just one super visual example. We did a story where we asked people, you know, what they thought about President Trump's ambitions and how they felt about, if that were to come to pass, potentially becoming a part of the U.S. And we went to a place called Nuuk Center, which is like the biggest mall in Greenland.
Mm-hmm.
And we're standing there at the doors and we're just like sitting there asking people, hey, do you want to talk to us? Hey, can I ask you a question about President Trump?
Excuse me, can you speak?
And at one point, things got so bleak that I was actually sitting there tallying in my notepad how many people said no and how many people said yes. And we got more than a dozen no's before we even got one yes, and we only got one.
I've been in situations like that where you're going into a community that has just been inundated by reporters. And I found myself that, like, I don't even get the syllables of reporter out before I'm a nope. Like, I'm a
full stop.
Yeah. Yep. Nope. Like, or they could just tell by the body language as you come up that you're. But then eventually you were able to make connections. You were able to get people to talk about this. Did you find like a wide range? You know, you talk about it's a diverse place, but also it's a place with, you know, 57,000 people
yeah.
total. What was the mix of opinions on this strange situation Greenland finds itself in?
Well, on this topic, people were actually pretty uniform. There was a poll that came out shortly before we arrived in Greenland, and the stat was pretty striking to us. Just 6% of Greenlanders said that they wanted their island to become part of the United States. Just 6%. And that really bore itself out as we were going around and talking to people. The thing that sticks in my mind that I kept hearing over and over and over again from people is they would say, Greenland is not for sale. That is something that Greenland's prime minister has said. That is something that's been echoed by Denmark's prime minister, because Greenland, of course, is an autonomous territory of Denmark.
Mm-hmm.
That just was the thing that people kept coming back to. It is very clear that they don't want to be taken over. I think someone told us at one point, we don't want another colonizer. I'm paraphrasing here a bit.
Yeah.
But I will say we did meet one sort of very big Trump super fan, this guy named Jorgen Bosen. He actually helped orchestrate Don Jr., President Trump's son's visit to Greenland that happened, I think, a little bit before the inauguration. And what's interesting about him and listening to him when we sat down with him is that even he didn't come out and say that he wanted the U.S. to acquire the island. He made the case that he wants to see Greenland enter what's called a free association agreement with the United States. So he wants to see the United States provide economic support, military support, defense support. But he kind of stopped short of saying that he wanted to be part of this country. He did not say that he wants to be American.
What do you, like, I feel like when we're going on a reporting trip, we do a ton of research. We done a ton of prep before we go, figuring out what we want to talk about, who we want to talk to, but just also like the basics of the story, because you don't want to walk in blind. And yet there are always really big surprises. Like, what was most surprising to you about this trip? And what was something that maybe you thought about, I didn't quite grasp this idea at all, or I had it a little bit wrong when I was thinking about it from afar?
The thing that surprised me the most was how challenging it would be to get people to talk. Like, I knew the influx of journalists would be there, and I know they had had so much attention. Mm-hmm. And, like, on these trips, you know, you pre-plan so much. You do pre-interviews. You send emails. But, like, that's just not the way that things happen there. It's very much an island where the best interviews we got, I think, were by way of introduction of someone else. The people who really stuck with me the most were people that we were introduced to, either by our fixer, Yona, that we worked with, or by other people that we had met. The word of mouth currency was just so much more important. When I told most people in my life, like outside of our business, hey, I'm going to Greenland for this trip, most people came in with the baseline of knowing nothing about this island.
Yeah.
And I think that that's really flattened the culture in some ways. So we were really intentional about doing stories. Yes, we talked about President Trump's ambitions, but we also talked about dog sledding. We also went to a kayak club and watched the construction of traditional Greenlandic kayakers. We sat down with an award-winning Greenlandic chef who talked to us about indigenous cuisine and the food landscape there. So I think for me, what was most enriching was trying to open up those other parts of Greenland to a U.S. audience that really hasn't given this place and its people and its history, like, much consideration.
Juana Summers, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thanks, Scott.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. If you are looking for a professional change, you'll need to polish your resume. And even if you're not looking for a new job, update it anyway. Career coach Cynthia Pong says you never know when the right job will come along and you'll want to send that resume over without delay.
It's kind of one of those be ready so you don't have to get ready type of things.
But resume shaping can be stressful. So Marielle Segarra of NPR's Life Kit podcast has some tips for you.
All right. Our goal here is to bring you one step closer to the job you want. See how I summarized there at the top of the piece? That's what you want to do on your resume. After you put down your personal info, name, email, phone number, at the very top, Pong says you should write a several-sentence summary.
So you can think of this as your mission statement.
And this is a way to show the hiring manager why you'd be a great fit for this job.
Especially if you're someone who other folks tend to underestimate what you bring to the table, or you're doing something non-traditional in your career, or you're a career changer, something like that.
Pong, by the way, is the founder of the career coaching firm Embrace Change. So she says about 3 to 5 lines here, really a few sentences at most. And this is who you are professionally in a nutshell. You can start with some adjectives: engaging, thorough, creative, and then your role or desired role.
And then you could say, you know, podcast host for mission-driven audio initiatives and organizations. And then I would say something like, excels at X, Y, and Z.
And the last sentence of the summary can be something about where you're going with your career. You know, is there an arc to it? Do you know what kind of roles you'd like next? After the summary, Pong suggests that you include a section called core competencies,
where you list a maximum of 4 to 6 areas where you really excel.
So look at the job posting, you know, see what they're looking for, what keywords they use, and how those align with your skills. Just make sure you're not repeating what's in your summary. Okay, next up is work experience. You're going to list the relevant places you've worked, plus the years you were there. And maybe if the company isn't a household name, you can put down a few words about what it does. Then you'll put bullet points under each job that show what you've achieved or accomplished. If you have a gap in your resume, you can put down things like unpaid community work, freelance work, education or skills development, basically other things you did during that time.
Now, the only other footnote I'd add here is if it is a very long gap or you otherwise feel kind of compelled to proactively frame what happened here for folks, then you could include that in the cover letter. But either way, you know, be prepared to discuss it in the interview confidently if and when you get to that stage.
Also, if you took a while off from working because you were sick, for instance, or caring for a loved one, you could write something like medical leave or sabbatical on your resume and list the year. After that, in the lower third of your resume, you're going to list other skills, languages, software programs you know, also educational experience. You don't have to put down your date of graduation, especially if you're concerned about age discrimination, but it is good to include your major.
Because you never know what could spark a connection between you and whoever ultimately is reading the resume.
And you can have a section for awards or volunteer or community work or publications or leadership roles in industry groups. After that, proofread your resume, maybe have a friend or a mentor look it over, and it's ready to go. Hope you get the job. For NPR News, I'm Marielle Segarra.
This is NPR News.
The United States has imposed tariffs on China, so we've come here to the streets of Beijing to get a sense of China's response. I'm Steve Inskeep. We'll listen to some of the conversation inside the United States' great global rival, starting Monday on Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm Windsor Johnston with these headlines. Officials say at least three people were killed after Russia launched a series of drone strikes across Ukraine last night. The latest attacks come ahead of ceasefire negotiations in Saudi Arabia. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney is calling for a parliamentary election next month. Carney emphasized the need to protect Canada's economic stability amid threats of annexation and tariffs from the United States. Israel has resumed airstrikes in Lebanon this weekend. Officials say at least seven people have been killed, including a child. Israel says it's targeting Hezbollah militants. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at AJWS.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow. As soon as he returned to office, President Trump began to remake the federal government swiftly, aggressively, in his image.
The president has been talking about his day one actions, and it's believed 200 orders will be executed.
A requirement that federal workers return to full-time in-person work immediately.
The administration plans to issue a new memo in the coming days directing agencies to prepare for large-scale firings.
Trump has made it clear that one of the key goals of his second term is to shrink the size and scope of the federal workforce and eliminate programs he doesn't like.
We're removing all of the unnecessary, incompetent, and corrupt bureaucrats from the federal workforce.
Tens of thousands of federal government employees have already been fired.
Thursday is when things started coming to a halt. We started pausing meetings. There was a palpable tension in the air. And we started receiving emails from our new acting administrator.
That is a federal employee who was fired in the early days of Trump's second term. She's with the United States Department of Agriculture, or USDA, and spoke to us on the condition of anonymity because she fears retribution in the workplace. For the past couple of months, she was doing a fellowship program that had her working at the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID.
I logged on and I got an email, which was just a copy and paste template that they sent to probationary employees telling me that because of my, quote, poor performance, I was determined unfit for the civil service, and that's why I was being terminated. My supervisors did not know. I had to be the one to notify them that I was no longer under their employment.
And to her, that felt strange. She says she had received glowing performance reviews. She felt her work was important. She was doing things like helping new mothers and infants with nutrition and food security in developing countries.
The priorities that this office works on is the first 1,000 days of life. So when a woman finds out she's pregnant, all the way up until a child is 2 years old.
Soon, nearly the entire staff had either been put on paid administrative leave or fired. And the majority of the department's programs ended.
It's devastating. We worked on child wasting, for example, is when a child has a low weight for their height. There are kids who will no longer receive treatment, who will slide back into wasting. There are families who really, really relied on this care.
The choice to unilaterally dissolve a federal agency, one established by Congress, was a shock to Washington, but the concept at the heart of it, that the president has broad authority to act unilaterally without consequence, that the executive branch should reflect his priorities, stems from one idea, the unitary executive theory. It is an idea at the heart of a recent landmark Supreme Court ruling, Trump versus the United States, the immunity decision. And it is an idea that we are going to explore on this episode of Supreme Consequences, a series about the real-world impacts of the Supreme Court's rulings. One consequence for many federal workers, career stability.
Do I need to just make money where I can and hope for the best? But it would be sad to give up my version of what my career path was. But at this point, it seems like we just need the money. I mean, who cares about a dream at this point?
And her family's well-being.
I have an 18-month-old little boy. He's enrolled in a great daycare, and I don't think we're going to be able to afford to keep him there anymore. And my son has to get a procedure, and I'm already really stressed about the copay we have to pay for that. I have no idea how we're going to pay that. I'm already looking at the bills, and it makes me sweat. I don't know.
In the past month, two federal judges have ordered federal agencies to reinstate thousands of federal employees, including those at USDA. Decisions the Trump administration strongly disagrees with and is appealing. And that has led to a stressful state of limbo. For the time being, they have jobs, but only until the appeals process plays out. It's not clear to the employee we talked to or others whether this is permanent or just another few weeks. The legal back and forth center on questions about the limits of President Trump's power. It is a power that was expanded by the Supreme Court last summer through its ruling in Trump versus the United States, the immunity case.
In a 6-3 opinion, the Supreme Court ruled the former presidents have absolute immunity from prosecution for official acts related to their core constitutional powers.
Orders the Navy SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival immune.
This decision was written as if America has never had a corrupt president.
Organizes a military coup to hold on to power, immune.
This is one of the worst opinions in American history from the Supreme Court.
Immune, 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 immune.
The decision came down to a key question that has big implications on topics far beyond the criminal case at the heart of it. When a president does something that is potentially illegal while executing his duties, who or what can regulate his actions? Who can hold him accountable? These questions have come up a lot in the first weeks of Trump's second term in different contexts. From dismantling agencies established by Congress to deporting migrants without due process. President Trump is asserting his power. And one idea that seems to be motivating his actions is the unitary executive theory. But where does this idea come from and how does it relate to the Supreme Court?
Many of the judges currently on the Roberts Court who embrace the unitary executive theory, which is a muscular understanding of a president's Article II powers. Part of it is how we understand the president's powers when it comes to war, emergency, foreign policy.
That's Amanda Hollis-Brewski. She's a politics professor at Pomona College, where she teaches classes about the Supreme Court. The theory started to gain traction and developed in the Reagan administration among a group of young attorneys in the Justice Department who thought the presidency had recently been weakened.
The Reagan Justice Department had a deep sense that since Watergate and the post-Watergate reforms that sought to really rein in and control an imperial president, right, to prevent another Watergate, to prevent another president from abusing the trappings of their office, to prevent corruption in government, that the Congress that was elected after Nixon resigned went too far.
The Reagan administration were quite animated about efforts to restore presidential authority to its true scope under Article II.
Charles Cooper was Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Reagan administration.
And that's where the concept of the unitary executive kind of was born. There is only one president, one chief executive, and that chief executive, under the clear command of Article II, possesses all of the executive power of the federal government.
So how did this idea that was discussed among young government lawyers make its way to the federal courts and eventually to the Supreme Court? Hollis Bruski points to one major factor, the Federalist Society. She wrote the book Ideas with Consequences, The Federalist Society and the Conservative Counter-Revolution. It documents the group's founding by a group of conservative law students in the 1980s.
As the founders of the Federal Society were going through their coursework, they were looking for the ideas that had excited them that were becoming ascendant on a national level. So ideas like limited government, free market capitalism, anti-regulation, and those were largely absent in their conversations in law school. And so they got together and said, how do we bring these perspectives into our law schools?
Hollis Bruski spoke with many of the Federal Society's founders and explains how they were thinking about growing their influence.
It's the network. It was important that the founders recognized within the law specifically, if you want to build and strengthen conservatism in the law, you needed the law schools, yes, but you also then needed folks who were active in public interest law. You need folks who were active in positions of power within the executive branch. And finally, of course, as we know, you need the judges.
Judges, a key part of shaping American law. Cooper, who worked in Reagan's Justice Department, has been active in the Federalist Society for years.
The Reagan administration was quite devoted to trying to identify potential nominees to the bench who adhered to the kind of conservative legal philosophy that the Federalist Society was founded to develop, to debate, to advance, and it has become extremely successful.
And that success has continued over many Republican administrations, creating what some call a pipeline to the federal bench, especially to the Supreme Court.
Chief Justice Roberts, he was my colleague. He was just down the hall from me.
And tonight I'm honored to announce that I am nominating him to serve as Associate Justice of the Supreme Court.
Justice Alito was in the Reagan administration.
I'm pleased to announce my nomination of Judge Samuel A. Alito, Jr.
Justice Thomas, a couple of important posts in the Reagan administration.
Judge Clarence Thomas, to serve as Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court.
Other justices in different later administrations, but still executive branch officials, Kavanaugh.
Judge Brett Kavanaugh.
Gorsuch.
Judge Neil Gorsuch.
There's no question that it has become a very effective organization for the promoting of the tenets of a conservative legal philosophy that conservative administrations understandably are interested in seeing ascend into prominence on the federal bench.
But Cooper says the Trump presidency took it to another level.
I believe it was unprecedented that a president actually published a list of names that the president would likely consider for appointment to the Supreme Court.
With President Trump in the White House and Republicans in control of the Senate, the conditions in 2017 were ripe for the unitary executive theory to go mainstream.
This is so much bigger than Donald Trump. This is so much bigger than one president. This is about the presidency.
That's Mike Davis, a conservative legal activist who once worked as chief counsel for nominations for Senator Chuck Grassley, who chaired the powerful Senate Judiciary Committee. Davis oversaw the floor votes for hundreds of judicial nominees, nominees that reshaped the federal bench. That includes now Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch.
Justice Neil Gorsuch is a very close friend and a mentor.
Gorsuch, who was Trump's first Supreme Court pick, wasn't even on that initial list from the campaign of potential nominations, which is something Davis quickly worked to fix.
And I got him on the second list, and I did it by basically beat down every door I could to make sure he was put on that list and then make sure he was picked and make sure he was confirmed and set up.
Davis now runs the Article 3 Project, a conservative legal group that is trying to install what he calls constitutionalist judges on the federal bench. One issue he cares a lot about, a powerful chief executive.
We can't have a president of the United States worried that what he does as the president of the United States in his official capacity is going to end up having him indicted and thrown in prison by his successor. That would destroy the presidency and therefore destroy our country.
That argument was a key part of the court's ruling. But what about the other branches of government? Where do they fit in when a president could do whatever he or she wants to as a leader and not face consequences?
That was an astonishing decision. I think it is a turning point not only in Supreme Court law on the separation of powers, but also really in the trajectory of the country and democracy. I don't think it can be overstated how transformative it was, because the court essentially put the president above the Constitution, above the rule of law, above Congress, above the judiciary, above juries, above everything.
That's Kim Whaley. She is a constitutional law professor. And earlier in her career, she worked for independent counsel Kenneth Starr as he investigated Bill Clinton's presidency. I asked Whaley if she sees a connection between the immunity decision and President Trump's actions, actions like closing USAID and firing thousands of federal employees.
Yes, that's a direct line to the unitary executive theory. I mean, bear in mind, Article 2 says the president can appoint executive branch officials, hire them. It does not say he can remove them for any reason. The Constitution's silent on that.
Right now, there are a number of lawsuits challenging the legality of Trump's ability to fire federal employees, cases that may ultimately be decided by the Supreme Court. Already, five justices ruled that the Trump administration must pay $2 billion to USAID contractors for work they've already completed.
So that was not a good decision for the expansion of executive power for Donald Trump, but there were four dissenting justices, and Justice Alito wrote a very fiery dissent. So I think these are going to be close nail-biter decisions. Whether the Supreme Court will decide that Congress's design of federal agencies is beside the point, that not only can the president just demolish them as he sees fit, but can anoint a private party to do that with no ostensible legal or constitutional authority. And I say that because the courts can't really even figure out what Elon Musk's role is.
It's an open question on how the court will approach these matters. But in the meantime, Whaley says the immunity decision has emboldened Trump to push the envelope on what the executive branch can do. And in doing so, it's taken power from other branches of government.
Since Donald Trump took office a second time in January 20th, this is just a massive dismantling of a delicately created system of checks and balances where Congress does its job, passes laws that should be enforced and respected by the executive branch. Congress creates agencies, gives them their power, and that power is restrained by the law. And if you want more power in the president, then you have to go back to Congress. That's what's breaking down, and it's not entirely the Supreme Court's fault. It's also the fault of the United States Congress, which is not insisting on its own constitutional prerogative.
Welcome to Supreme Consequences, a series about how the Supreme Court's decisions affect people's lives. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19. The CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. And from USPS, USPS Ground Advantage service keeps customers in the know when their shipment leaves the dock, when it's on the move, and when it's delivered. Learn more at usps.com/in-the-know. This is NPR.